The headlines, President Raisi in Moscow. High-profile talk says Iran seeks maximum interaction with the world, specifically with its neighbors and allies. North Korea warns the U.S.'s hostile policy is approaching a danger line and preparations must get underway for a long-term confrontation. Plus, Iran, Russia, and China carry out joint military exercises in the north of the Indian Ocean. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. We begin with Moscow, where Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is paying the second and final day of an official visit. About an hour ago, the President delivered an address to Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament. In his speech, Raisi said Iran is seeking maximum interaction with all countries around the world, especially its neighbors and allies. He blasted sanctions as a modern form of dominance and called for a collective response to counter such measures. In a reference to Iran's 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA, the Iranian president said Tehran is serious about reaching an agreement only if other countries are serious about removing sanctions in an effective and practical manner. Raisi reiterated Iran's policy based on a decree by the Supreme Leader that nuclear weapons have no place in Iran's defense strategy. The president said strengthening relations between Iran and Russia can help sustain regional peace and stability. At their meeting that lasted for 3 hours in Moscow on Wednesday, the presidents of Iran and Russia assigned their foreign ministers to lay out a roadmap for mutual cooperation over the next 2 decades. Now Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says he and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, will get to work immediately. He says Ebrahim Raisi and Vladimir Putin discussed a spectrum of issues of mutual interest, with trade being at the heart of the conversation. Iran's economy minister, Ehsan Khanduzi, also says that Tehran and Moscow have reached an agreement on facilitating bilateral banking transactions. He says they've agreed to accelerate projects based on a $5 billion credit line, including 3 power generator stations and 2 rail and transit projects.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Official data from China confirms the first imports of Iran's crude oil in a year despite the ongoing U.S. sanctions. According to data from the Chinese customs, the country brought in 260,000 tons of Iranian crude oil in December. It's not clear which company imported the latest cargo. Imports from Iran have accounted for about 6% of China's crude oil supply. The U.S. left a major international deal with Iran known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and reimposed sanctions on the country in 2018. A year later, in April, the U.S. threatened to impose secondary sanctions on countries that continue to buy oil from Iran after an initial six-month waiver expired. North Korea is hinting that it may resume its nuclear and long-range missile tests to bolster its defense against the United States. North Korea's official news agency says leader Kim Jong-un has recently chaired a Politburo meeting of the ruling Workers' Party. The Politburo has given instructions to reconsider starting, or rather restarting, all temporarily suspended activities. It appears to be a reference to the country's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, which it voluntarily halted in 2017. That was during Pyongyang's negotiations with Washington for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula that bore no result. Now the North says a hostile U.S. policy has reached a level that cannot be ignored anymore. The Politburo is urging more thorough preparation for what it calls a long-term confrontation with the U.S. Our correspondent Frank Smith says North Korea could resume its missile tests as a countermeasure to offset Washington's breach of promises.
Well, I think that could mean the resumption of ICBM, of long-range missile tests, and perhaps even nuclear tests. If we go back to 2018, to the Singapore summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump, there was an agreement at that summit that Kim Jong-un offered, and that was the suspension of those long-range missile tests and nuclear tests. Up until now, he has kept his promise. However, the U.S. hasn't kept theirs, which is to engage North Korea in honest negotiations for a denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. At the Hanoi summit that took place between Trump and Kim later on, the U.S. really withdrew any potential concessions in terms of relief from the United Nations Security Council sanctions. Kim kept his promise, again, up until now. Recently, however, North Korea has launched short-range missiles, and the U.S. has implemented further sanctions against North Korea over those launches. In addition, the U.S. has relieved South Korea from limitations on its ballistic missile programs. So we can see how tension is building here on the Korean Peninsula.
Iran, China, and Russia conduct a massive naval drill in north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day drill will engage the latest vessels of the three countries with the aim of boosting coordination and synergy between their navies. Yusuf Jalani reports from the location of the drill.
Russian and Chinese naval vessels arrived in Iran's southern waters after sailing thousands of kilometers to take part in a joint drill with Iran's naval forces. Codenamed the Maritime Security Belt, the one-day drill will be conducted on Friday over a 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean.
The Maritime Security Belt Maneuvers 2022 will be conducted with the participation of 11 vessels from the Iranian Army's Navy, 3 vessels from the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, 3 vessels from the Russian Federation, and 3 vessels from the People's Republic of China.
We came here to conduct a successful drill. I hope that we'll achieve our set goals as we have done in the previous drills with Iran.
Russia's Pacific Fleet has deployed a flotilla comprising its guided missile cruiser, Varyag, and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tributes. China has also sent its Urumqi destroyer. This as Iran has used its latest domestically built destroyers, Dina and Jamaran, as well as its guided missile vessel, Tabarzin.
Given the common interests of most countries in north of the Indian Ocean, our joint drills seek to enhance coordination and synergy between the three navies, to bolster the security of maritime trade and combat piracy and marine terrorism.
China, Russia, and Iran's naval cooperation is an all-win measure that ensures the safety of international shipping. Most of Russia's international trade is carried out through maritime shipment. Iran also relies on shipping for its oil exports. China's imports of oil and gas and some other foreign trade depend on sea transit as well. so the trilateral drill is seen as an important step towards safeguarding the economic security for the three countries. It's the third time Iran is holding a joint naval exercise with Russia and China. Officials say the trilateral drill is not aimed at any specific country and seeks to encourage all actors in the region to join hands for a collective security in regional waters. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian port city of Chabahar.
Fresh developments out of the South China Sea, where tensions are ongoing. China says it has warned away a U.S. warship near the Paracel Islands. The Chinese military says its naval and air forces tracked the USS Benfold after it illegally sailed into China's territorial waters. On Thursday, the Army says Washington has two options, either to stop such provocative moves or bear the serious consequences of unforeseen events. But the U.S. Navy is repeating its long-standing claims that the warship asserted its navigational right that it is allowed under international law. These exchanges show that the issue of the South China Sea continues to remain a flashpoint in the bumpy relations between Beijing and Washington. China says the U.S. frequently violates its sovereignty in the strategic waterways, and Washington challenges China's territorial claims as unlawful. And the U.S. president ups the ante against Russia in his inauguration anniversary presser, vowing to impose tough sanctions on Moscow if Ukraine is invaded.
And so I think what you're going to see is that Russia will be held accountable if it invades. And it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine, and that our allies and partners are ready to impose severe cost and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy.
Biden says his guess is that Russian President Vladimir Putin will launch an incursion into Ukraine. However, he notes that Putin does not want a full-blown war. Biden warns that Russia will no longer be able to deal in dollars in case of an act of aggression. He adds that Washington could work out a plan whether to station, quote, strategic weapons in Ukraine. Biden says it was unlikely that Ukraine could join NATO in the near term, as it still needed to work on democratic reforms. A number of British MPs have brushed aside claims that they are unfairly targeting Bahrain, as observers say the kingdom has a well-documented and abysmal human rights record, and Bahrain is trying to silence British parliamentarians and peers calling it out. Bianca Raimi tells us more from London.
Bahrain has a tiny population of 1.7 million, but boasts the highest prison population per capita. Thousands of those are political prisoners. Every family has members who have done time, and the stories of torture and abuse are harrowing. Human rights organizations and defenders have been documenting them for years. But this man, Omar Al-Hassan, the chairman of the Persian Gulf Center for Strategic Studies, has accused UK MPs and peers of making biased and fabricated criticisms of Bahrain. The kingdom's rulers are squirming in the wake of more and more criticism coming from Britain.
My lords, earlier this year I raised with the noble lord Lord Ahmed the detention of children in Bahrain following reports of their physical abuse and forced confessions.
My lords, a year ago this week, the Bahrain's courts upheld the death penalty for Mohammed Ramadan and Hussein Musa, following commitments made to do so in the other place by the Minister for the Middle East and North Africa. What representations has Her Majesty's government made to the government of Bahrain on the death penalty?
The GCSS says Bahrain's interventions show, quote, ignorance and disregard for the many achievements Bahrain has made and is proud of in terms of human rights. But the UK seems unfazed by this. The GCSS is notorious for defending Bahrain's human rights record, and its chairman, Omar Al-Hassan, stands accused of being in the pocket of the Bahraini embassy in the UK. According to Liberal Democrat Pierre Lord Scriven, the GCSS's claims are nothing more than a continuation of the amateurish and slapdash approach by the Bahraini authorities to try and deny their appalling human rights record and undermine or try to silence those of us who speak up. Nonetheless, the UK and Bahrain are strategic allies, and the UK is reluctant to turn words into actions when it comes to defending Bahrain's prisoners of conscience. This is just another example of the hypocrisy and double standards exercised by Western governments that benefit from maintaining the status quo. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And Tehran is hosting an exhibition of innovative nanotechnology products. The event provides an opportunity to create links between companies with cutting-edge technology and the industrial sector. Salman Kujuri reports on that.
Iran Nanotechnology Innovative Council is holding an exhibit in Tehran to display the country's latest nanotech achievements. Almost 50 new nanoproducts and services in medicine, industry, construction, the environment, and energy are displayed at the four-day event. Over 450 science-based and industrial companies are active in nanotechnology in Iran, which have produced over 800 nanoproducts, exporting to over 40 countries worldwide. The exhibition is aimed at contributing to the commercialization of nanotechnology, exploring the existing potentials in the field of nanotechnology and introducing them to the market, as well as establishing research industry bonds and collaborations in the field. Among the innovations, there is another product related to water treatment using nanobubbles of gas. This system can develop the methods of treating wastewater, something substantial throughout the world. In today's world, nanotechnology is seen as a cutting-edge technology, which can be applied in all industrial fields and promote quality and efficiency of products significantly.
Iran has been introduced as the fourth leading country in the world in the field of nanotechnology, publishing over 11,000 scientific articles in this field back in 2020. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
کار رو برای خدا میکرد، تظاهر نداشت، لافزنی نداشت. خدای متعال اولین پاداش دنیایی که به این اخلاص او داد همین تشییع 10 میلیونی بود.
He would work because of God and he was free of pretentious behavior and boasting. The first worldly reward that God, the Exalted, bestowed on him for his sincerity after his being killed was his burial ceremony in which tens of millions of people participated. That burial ceremony was his first worldly reward for his sincerity, and of course, there is his reward in the hereafter. The popularity of Shahid Soleimani's name, personality, and memory was his worldly reward. After the past 2 years, Martyr Soleimani's name has been repeated and written by various individuals thousands and thousands of times. This year too, people themselves have organized commemoration ceremonies for him. But as I said, I will get to this topic. These are due to the sincerity of that dear Shaheed.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
شهید سلیمانی الگو شد. یکی از حقایق بسیار برجسته اینه که شهید سلیمانی تبدیل شد به یک الگو.
شهید سلیمانی became a role model. An outstanding reality is that Shahid Soleimani has become a role model. Today, many of the youth in the Islamic world, and particularly in the region, the information that I have is related to the region, are thirsty for the emergence of heroes such as Shahid Soleimani. They are thirsty for such heroes. The more the memory of Shahid Soleimani is promoted, the thirstier and more enthusiastic they become for the presence of such heroes in their own countries. In our region today, Martyr Soleimani is a symbol of hope, self-confidence and courage. He is the secret to resistance and victory. These things are in the hands of God, not in the hands of anyone else. The likes of people such as us cannot accomplish such things, no matter what strategy we use. Such things are done by God Himself.
جریان ضد استکباری در منطقه، جریان مقاومت در منطقه امروز از دو سال پیش پر رونق‌تر و شادابتر و امیدوارتر داره حرکت میکنه و کار میکنه.
The anti-arrogance movement and the resistance movement in the region are moving forward in a stronger, more dynamic and more hopeful way than 2 years ago. In Syria, the enemies are faced with a dead end. The enemies in Syria have no hope for the future. These are blessings from that dear innocent blood.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Monday, the Yemeni army conducted retaliatory strikes on several targets in the United Arab Emirates. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country launched 5 ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, an oil refinery in Musaffa, and several other sensitive and important sites in the UAE. Local officials said 3 people were killed and 6 others injured after 3 fuel tanker trucks exploded in the storage facility of an Emirati oil firm in the Musaffa area. Fires erupted in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, disrupting flights. This came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army said Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. The army warned the coalition of more painful attacks if it continues its aggression against Yemen.
Just because it is possible to bully or invade a country with little resistance, such as the cases with Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, doesn't mean that it should be done, and that countries have more of a responsibility to each other and the international community than they do to their own immediate self-gain. I had the privilege of attending many protests in favor of Yemen and protests to stop the bombing and the harassment of Yemen when I was in New York City. And you can see this is a genuine movement. This is a so many people from all different walks of life are recognizing the horrors that are being committed against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, by the backed UAE, and it has to come to an end.
The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes. Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jazan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes in Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians. And so I think that, I mean, Yemen should stand strong, the international community, the anti-imperialist international community should stand strong with Yemen and say absolutely not. Unless the UN is going to play fair and be neutral, and in this case be supportive of Yemen and the right to defense, then the UN has no business saying what should and should not be done in this conflict with the UAE.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed a blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism levelled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should step down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday. The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran's.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov Battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if de-escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were getting one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is the sentence of Izotso. He's saying that the only thing that I can say is that I feel that as if I am enchanted by Islam.
Besides this, he has a book that is talking about God and human being in the Holy Quran. And some other books that the subject of them are Quranic, you know, concepts and Quranic issues.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
We've wronged ourselves. What will we say in front of it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm your host, Ata. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Zainia. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
Sheikh Zainia, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So in the new series of the program, The Teacher, we are mainly concerned with the scholars, the ulama, the jurists, those researchers who are interested in Islamic studies. Most of them are Muslims, and the Shia Muslims, some of them are not Muslims. You know, they are among the non-Muslims who showed interest and dedication to Islamic studies and research on Islamic history. And The Teacher is mainly concerned with introducing such dignitaries and scholars all across the world of Islam. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of those non-Muslim, it's better to say, researchers on the text of the Holy Quran, whose name is Toshihiko Izotso. The linguist, philosopher, and a researcher of the Holy Quran, originally from Japan, who was born in 1914 in Tokyo. So, Sheikh Zainia, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life and the background of Toshihiko Izotso.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Professor Toshihiko Izotso was born in 4th day of May in 1914 in Tokyo, Japan. And he was professor in Islamic studies plus Arabic language and in philosophy and also in Eastern religions. He was born in a wealthy family, and his father was a wealthy man. And beside being wealthy, his father was strict Buddhist.
Okay.
So he was trying to, you know, bring up his son, a person who is firm Buddhist and as a person who, you know, believes in Buddhism deep in his heart. So because of that, Izutsu was tolerating and suffering from some sort of asceticism during his young age.
Okay.
And because of this, he was not, you know, that much satisfied with Buddhism.
Okay.
That's why he decides to study about different religions in his young age. And beside that, he didn't like, you know, studying economic. He started studying economic.
Yes.
But after all, he changed his major and started learning Arabic. And it's famous that he learned about 30 languages, from which he was fluent in at least 17 languages. He was understanding and writing and reading in these languages, amongst which was Persian, was Arabic, was many different languages, English. So he's also dedicated his life in studying language, and beside that, he was interested in different religions and philosophy. That's why he moved to Montreal and taught there. And in Montreal, he got familiar with Professor Muhaqqiq, a person who made Izotso familiar with Iran. And from that moment on, Izotso had many travels to Iran. After all, he even stayed about 7 years, 6 years in Iran.
Okay.
And he left Iran in 1978. I want to add a point here that you mentioned Izotso was not a Muslim. It's famous that he was not a Muslim.
Yes.
But the director of a documentary about Izotso that is made in Iran, the name is The Eastern.
Yes.
The director says that it's famous that Izotso is not a, was not a Muslim, but I do believe that according to the documents that he has collected during you know, the work that he had done, he believes that Izotso was converted into Islam and was a Muslim.
As Sheikh Ziya mentioned, you know, most of his researchers were regarding Islamic studies, especially Islamic philosophy, Islamic hikmah, and Islamic mysticism. Of course, the people who come from Japan, originally somehow in their sectarian beliefs, have such trainings, I mean, mystical, ascetic, we can say, teachings in the Eastern traditions, and that's why they believe in such a spiritual trainings and movements, and nowadays we can find it too. But what made Izotso interested in Islamic philosophy, Irfan, and Hikmah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
This is a very nice question. Why I'm saying that this is a very nice question, because as you mentioned, this is something typical that most of the time when we look at the history of the people who are coming from the East, because of the environment they grew in, they have this tendency upon Irfan, asceticism, mysticism, things which has something to do with the spiritual aspect of the life.
Yes.
This is something which is typical. But what made the scholar like Izotso to be interested in Islamic version of spirituality? That's why this is a nice question to know about it.
Yes.
So I think this is good to ask this question from the very person, Izotso.
Okay.
And he was asked this question. Why? Because he had produced a lot of works in terms of Islamic philosophy, Islamic mysticism. So this is very strange. What made you to get interested in Islam? Because we have different versions of spirituality here and there in the West or East.
Yes.
But what made you to get interested in Islamic version of it? And in response, he says that, I can't say anything. And my interest upon Islamic philosophy and Islamic mysticism is a kind of mysterious interest. Even within myself, I cannot understand why I am interested. The only thing that I can say, this is the sentence of Izotso,
okay,
is saying that the only thing that I can say is that I feel that as if I am enchanted by Islam. So I think this could be considered as a complementary point, or we may say supplementary point, for what our brother Sheikh Diyanya mentioned, that the director of that documentary believes that he had converted. We don't know what happened
in reality.
Yes.
But this is something which is quoted from Izotso, and I think it helps us a lot in this regard.
This documentary is called Sharqi in Farsi, which roughly can be translated from East or Eastern, you know. It was directed and produced and written by Masoud Taheri. It is about the life of Izotso. But Sheikh Ziyaniyah, one of the other main interests of Izotso was the Holy Quran. What details can you give us about his research methodology about the Holy Quran?
Okay, you know, because Quran is the main text in the religion of Islam, that's why every person who wants to work in Islamic studies automatically is pushed toward the Holy Quran. So Izotso was not an exception regarding this, and he started translating the Holy Quran from Arabic into Japanese. And that was the first time that this process was done by a Japanese person. Of course, he was not the last. We talked that previously that Professor Sawada also translated Quran from Arabic into Japanese. But Izotso is the first person who tries this.
Yes.
And he translated the Holy Quran in three volumes into Japanese. And he had some theories regarding this, of course, because it's a technical discussion, so I do not want him to go into the details. But he has a theory regarding the translation of the Quran. He has some books regarding this. He has a theory regarding the semantic of the words of the Holy Quran, how to translate them, how to, you know, get closer to the concepts of the words. Of course, he do believe that some of the words in every language, as he says this, that some of the words in every language are not translatable. You are not able to translate these words.
Yes.
But he gives some ways to get closer to the concepts. Beside this, he has a book that is talking about God and human being in the Holy Quran. And some other books that the subject of them are Quranic, you know, concepts and Quranic issues. That shows that he was maybe absorbed by the teachings of the Holy Quran, and he dedicated at least some years of his life, let me say the ending part of his life, for researching and writing and working about Islamic studies. And it's interesting that when he returns from Iran to Japan in 1978, he tries to work and write his books in Japanese, not in English. And he says that I want to transfer these teachings into Japanese language because I do believe that these, you know, ideas are needed in Japanese language. So he does not writing his books in
English.
English.
That's right.
On that part of his life. Before that, he had some works in English, but at the ending part of his life, he tries to write the books in Japanese. And we should know that the ending moments of his life was like this, that he fell down in his house. He got a strike, and he thought that it's not something serious. Of course, it was a brain bleeding, but he was not aware of that. That's why he told his wife that I'm going to have some sleep and rest. And he slept and never woke up again in this world. But we ask Almighty God to send blessings to his soul, because he dedicated much of his time regarding Quran and Islamic studies, and he is valuable in this regard and noticeable.
That's right. The point that you mentioned about leaving this legacy in their own mother languages about Islam is really important. The program, the teacher is also interested in finding the people who have left different works on different fields of studies regarding the religion of Islam in their own mother tongues, you know, whether it be Japanese, you know, we can say the African ones or any type of language. Okay, Sheikh Matavi, any point missed? We got a final moments of our program for today's discussion.
Actually, I think this is good to appreciate the role of people whom Izotso met in his life.
Okay.
If we look at the works of Izotso, we can say that
he received a good influence from the works or from the discussions that he had with the contemporary scholars.
Yes.
Henry Corbin, Said Hussein Nas, there are people whom he met and they had a discussion together. So these meeting which brings people and scholars from East and the West, and yes, they sit around one table, yes, and discuss about Islamic issues with different backgrounds, and we see the fruits.
Yes.
So this is something that we have to appreciate.
Yeah, the dialogue between, yeah, different people from different religions, that's the real picture that the believing people around the world are looking for. I mean, interfaith and intrafaith dialogue and unity between all the believers with respect, and you know, this can be found in the scholars. And unfortunately, in the recent years, we could see that the picture that is shown out of the religion of Islam in the Western media is converse and vice versa. It is a barbaric, violent, you know, picture of Islam. But the beautiful side of Islam is these scholarly discussions, you know, among the Muslims and non-Muslims regarding the Holy Quran and the history of Islam. And I think this beautiful aspect is really fascinating. And I invite all non-Muslims to read about Islam and do more research about Islam. January 7th, 1993, Toshihiko Izotso passed away in Japan. May Allah bless his soul. One of the we can say people who dedicated his life on research in Islamic mysticism, hikmah, philosophy, and also the text of the Holy Quran. Thank you, Sheikh Mahdavi.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziyania.
You're most welcome.
For your presence in the program, the teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program, visit our website at parstoday.com/Sashi and Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
What is it you would be trying to do on climate change? What is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming, okay? When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming, I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
Having two cars, three cars in your family and a television set in every room and living that sort of life that people live in developed countries and even in emerging economies now has a cost to it. The cost is climate change.
And the time is running out. Time is running out. We've got 10, as the scientists say, we have 10 years to reduce our emissions by 90%. You know, we've got to keep 80% of the fossil fuels in the ground. That's a massive shift in our ways of life.
It is going to affect the way we do everything. It is going to affect the way we transport ourselves. It's going to affect what we eat, when we eat. It's going to affect how we heat, cool our homes. It's going to affect how we build our homes. It's going to affect mostly, certainly how we produce our food. It's going to affect practically every human endeavor.
If we failed in Paris,
then the whole world is looking at a globally catastrophic situation, which will not spare anybody. It will hit the rich countries. New York will be affected, Berlin will be affected, London will be affected. It will affect everybody.
The average temperature on Earth has already risen by 1 degree Celsius. If we exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, most ecosystems will collapse. To prevent this, the United Nations